Got your water?
Yeah, do you have your water?
Yeah.
Okay, good, because I've already started recording. Welcome to the MacGuffin Man. I'm Alex, and with me, and properly hydrated, is James. You can check out our website, themacguffinman.com, to keep up on all of our podcasts. We most recently discussed Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels, Dunkirk before that, Prisoners, The Thing, and Baby Driver. And I've also written a handful of things recently, so you can read those if you like. Yeah, follow us on Twitter at the MacGuffin Man, and theme song.
Welcome to the MacGuffin Men. And now, here are Alex and James.
All right, James.
Yes.
We have returned from not war, just the theme song, and we have pulled up our weird cane stools to sit down and, and have a chat about a film.
So cool.
So cool. Such a baller move to just bring your own stool everywhere you go. And sit on it like AC Slater in what looks like a very uncomfortable sort of situation. But
I think it'd be more uncomfortable the other way. That seems to be the way that was designed to be sat on, at least.
Yeah, I think that was probably the way it was designed to be sat on, but I don't know. I guess there just doesn't seem to be a real good good way out of it. We're sitting on that thing for me, you know? Anyway, doesn't matter. This is such a minor detail of this film.
No, it's not.
Oh, okay. That's where the conspiracy lies.
It's the main visual metaphor of this movie. No, we're talking about The Manchurian Candidate, the 1962 one, the original.
The John Frankenheimer film.
Yes.
Yeah.
Based on the 1959 novel by Richard Condon.
Mhm.
And this is the beginning of John and Frankenheimer's directing career, or very early on, at least.
It's early on, and this is the movie that he is remembered for. Like, he has his legacy, I find, is there just isn't a lot that has sort of a lot of the movies he has done have sort of fallen by the wayside, you know. Like, I think a lot of times people remember him as the director of the French Connection, despite the fact that he only did the second one, you know.
Yeah.
But The Manchurian Candidate is the movie that he is remembered for. Also his legacy really took a hit towards the end of his career when he was doing stuff like The Island of Dr. Moreau and Reindeer Games, which was terrible. Ronin's a good movie that he made in the 90s, but yeah, he had a kind of an up and down career, you know. But this is the John Frankenheimer movie.
Yeah, it is. And I mean, I don't think it's not a name that I really gets mentioned very much anymore, I don't think. The term Manchurian Candidate has kind of crossed over into popular culture, just being a phrase and a term that people know. And in researching this movie, just the amount of Trump articles I came across, which I think it's just a vague connection to Russia, is pretty much the only true connection there. But the fact that it's still used and still so abused goes to speak to the point of just how popular a term it has become.
Yeah, and also just political corruption is something that we always find entertaining. House of Cards is now officially a long-running show. And I mean, there was a reason it was easy to remake this movie in 2004. You could remake this movie every 10 years probably for the rest of organized democracy's history, you know, and and it would always you'd always be able to find something interesting in it. It's a genre that always has legs, because you know it's a genre built around not being able to get hard answers. So you can kind of do whatever you want as long as it sort of stays within some sort of confines of reality.
Yeah, and speaking truth to power is something that people who make it far enough in Hollywood that they get to do what they want is something they want to do.
Yeah, for sure.
And just the political thriller, it seems like John Frankenheimer is kind of crediting with pioneering, or at least fleshing out or putting into the forefront. I mean, obviously this was based on a novel, and people have been writing about politics and even writing fiction about politics for, you know, a very long time. But in what I've seen, they really kind of credit him with putting it in a marketable, interesting, sellable package that still, you know, is intellectually engaging, but still entertaining to watch. And I'd put that in that I'd put this movie in that category for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. And just due to my relative youth, like I don't have the personal experience to really say that myself, but it certainly feels that way from the research I've done, just like the research you've done. And also one thing that I found really, really interesting about this movie, I mean, it comes out at a time where the studio is really in that in-between, or Hollywood studios are really in that in-between space of the studio era and when we get towards the late 60s, where people start shooting on location a lot more, basically the American New Wave. And this movie really feels like an in-between of the studio system and the American New Wave, because like stylistically, for the most part, like it looks like a standard studio movie. There's a lot of noir tricks, shadows on the walls and stuff. But as far as like the way, I don't know, certain things about the movie really feel ahead of their time. And I think this movie feels really modern in some ways for 1962. Like it's especially like that dream sequence. I can't even imagine what that would have been like, watching that would have been like in 1962. You know,
I mean, the opening.
Yeah. The one where you're doing the spin, the full 360 spin and the set changes. That's awesome now. I don't know how I would have reacted in 1962. You know, I might have, like, if we saw this together, I might have made them stop the movie and did a celebration or something, because it's so good, you know? And just the movie in general is very fantastic, but fantastic in a pretty modern way, I would say.
No, I think you're right in that. Yeah, first of all, just I'll agree. I think that this is a movie I enjoyed, but it's strongest at its bookends. Like, I think the stuff at the convention is awesome, and I think that the introduction in a different way is very compelling. So I think those are kind of the stronger sequences, even though there's things I like throughout the movie. But what you're saying about it feeling kind of in between, yeah, I feel like it's very two-faced in a lot of ways, and I mean that positively. And I think that that is a sign of where this is in, you know, the Hollywood culture and the Hollywood economy between those two eras. And I think it kind of covers everything. I think this is a movie about being kind of two-faced. Obviously, you know, it's a sleeper agent, someone who acts one way and acts a different way and isn't even deceptive about it, you know, has no idea that they're acting in two different ways, because the memories don't seem to translate between those two, maybe not personalities, but those two forms of being that are inhabited by one person. And I think it's got that going for it, kind of being sort of two-faced. I think that it's very dark and very funny. I think it goes from this weird satire to this pretty heavy thriller at times. And yeah, just very broadly, I do agree with your statement that it does feel very ahead of its time. And it kind of looks old in a lot of ways, but then it looks incredibly modern in a lot of ways. And this was just a really weird one for me. I had no experience with this movie other than knowing that that was the title and the many meanings that it's brought on in the meantime. But it's a really interesting one as far as how much just territory it covers.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think one of the most modern things about this movie is, you know, if you're coming away from this movie thinking about anything outside of, you know, talking about conspiracy theories and whatnot, if you're thinking about something that this movie is about, you're thinking about PTSD, right? And the idea that Shaw went to war, you know, and what he did there will affect him for the rest of his life, you know, despite the fact that what he went through is a very unique sort of situation, you know, but that he's given the Medal of Valor, he comes away as the hero, and he still is the type of person who, no matter what he does for the rest of his life, because we see the end of his life in this movie, he is affected by what happened at war, you know. And I think there's a really telling scene when Josie says, I can make him well, to Marco, Sinatra's character. And and just like the first time watching through this movie, I was like, oh, that's not how this is going to go. And, you know, from a thriller angle, you kind of can tell that that's going to be the way that it goes. But also from the fact that by that point in the movie, there's probably like half an hour, 20 minutes left. You're starting to realize just how much of this movie is about PTSD and people having nightmares of their time in war. And, you know, it's a bit of an abstraction, because those nightmares that they are having are just very bizarre and mildly sci-fi. But yeah, it just sort of ends up being this movie about a guy who can never really leave what the war did to him, even though he was technically a war hero, you know?
Yeah, and comes home and is immediately used for political means by someone else, and someone he staunchly disagrees with, besides, you know, regardless of the fact that it's his mother and stepfather.
Yeah.
He disagrees very strongly. You know, he goes to work for a very left-leaning newspaper when that doesn't seem to be the politics of the generation above him in his family. So, yeah, the idea of coming back and sort of rejecting this hero status is something that we see a lot in these post-war movies in the coming decades. You know, this mm-hmm. is a big thing of Vietnam, this is a big thing of Iraq, this is a big thing of Afghanistan, and this is a book written in 59 and a movie that comes out in 62, and it's just very prescient in that way. And yeah, from the PTSD angle, just this idea that, you know, what you touched on, that he can never leave it behind, and it's obviously very exceptional, you know, it's very fantastic. We think of PTSD in a very real way, and this our way into it in this movie is, as you said, kind of sci-fi. It's this brainwashing thing that's pretty, to our knowledge, at least, unrealistic, but touches on something that is all too real in post-traumatic stress disorder. And we watch him fight with it for about 2 hours, and it ends in a very shocking suicide. You know, I didn't think that he was going to turn the gun on himself there, and the fact that it happened so quickly, it really adds to the jarring nature of it. I think if you want to try to communicate anything about the tragedy of that, is even though it is something that's, you know, painfully common, to have it done in that really quick and jarring way really drives it home for at least me emotionally.
Yeah, absolutely. And also that whole sequence leading up to his suicide is just very engaging, you know, and that there does come that surprise towards the end, right at the end of that sequence when he does turn the gun on himself, you know. It just sort of drives the excitement of that scene home, and then you also get the holy shit, he killed himself sort of angle of it, which, you know, the suspense that came before it makes it even more interesting. I want to go back to talking about the two-faced idea that you mentioned, because I agree wholeheartedly that runs all throughout the film. And, you know, even just sort of the idea of this war hero, what if the war hero is really the villain? Even to be a war hero, you typically are engaging in some sort of villainous activity to the opposite perspective, right? Chances are you've got to kill somebody to get a Medal of Valor awarded to you. But the thing that I found really interesting about this movie is the way that they play with the two-face aspect visually. And I thought, I mean, there are some good uses of shadows, especially on the private plane sequence early on. When Shaw is telling his mother that he's going to go work for the newspaper, you know, there's just a prominent shadow of him on the wall. It's like, who are these two people that we're looking at, sort of thing. But even as the movie goes on, even outside of those shadow opportunities, like, I think the best example is the hearing with the television screens, because what we are seeing, like, we are in the room where that event is happening and also watching a totally different visual representation of it. So we are seeing two things, or the same thing, from two distinctly different angles and two distinctly different perspectives. And I think that sort of wisely comments on you know, the way that perspective matters and how you feel, even just something like a letter or an email, the way that no matter what you say in that just takes on a different tone than somebody speaking to you, you know. It's just a different version of the same thing. And this is around the time of the this would have been around the time of the famous Nixon Kennedy television debate, right, where the people that were listening on the radio thought Nixon had won, but the people watching on television thought JFK had won, because Nixon was sweaty and just generally looked unintelligent. And and I just thought that was a really, really interesting visual thing to do, and I would imagine also very difficult to accomplish at the time with the technology, you know.
Yeah, and this being relatively early in television having such an impact. I think that they do a good job of putting television in a position of a lot of power, you know, to have it in there in those scenes you were talking about, to change the way that those that the conventions would have been, just mm-hmm. the setup of it, to have to play the cameras and things like that. This is just very early on in the market saturation of American television, and just to think of this movie being ahead of its time somewhat, that stuff just feels like, so much of that stuff about the way they shoot the convention just feels exactly how you would shoot it now. Mm-hmm. And it still looks very good and very engaging, and I think that's interesting.
Well, and sorry, go ahead.
Just the idea, the Two-Face thing is, you know, I kind of explained a bit about how it ties in with this idea of the assassination, you know, having a sleeper agent essentially ready to kind of flip the switch and become this different person. And this is definitely leaned on in the movie, but just this notion of being in a post-McCarthy time, you know, this the McCarthyism that was only still pretty recent at the time of the publication of this novel, a little bit more distance by the time this movie comes out. But this movie's set in the early 1950s, so this is, you know, the kind of the high time for McCarthyism, and just that idea that it could be your neighbor. You know, they talk about how it's screenwriters and actors and directors and executives who have this communist sympathy, but it's this idea that you can look at someone and not know who they are. And I think it's tough for us now to really think about communism in the way that communism was thought of at the time. I've just been totally coincidentally of this podcast, been reading and listening to podcasts on the subject, and they always start with trying to contextualize just how loaded that term was. Yeah. And it just seems like a different political, it just seems like a difference of opinion now. But that it's so far beyond that at this time period. And yeah, just that notion that a communist looks just like you and can sound just like you and can live next door. And, you know, it's not even a two-faced nature. There's just one face to these people, but they deep down that there's this massive, extremely important ideological divide, and maybe even beyond that, that they are fundamentally different people. And I think that all of this movie has to be kind of looked through that lens. I think this movie is still very interesting today, and it speaks to some things that it couldn't have known it was going to be speaking about, but I think that that's just a major thing we can't lose sight of, just given the political climate that this novel and movie would have been released in.
Yeah, absolutely. But yeah, another way that they do the Two-Face thing really well is that there are a few shots in this movie where there's somebody, I guess this isn't really Two-Face, but there's somebody in the foreground of a shot who is out of focus, and the focus of the shot is what's behind them. The first time this happens is when in the cold open of the movie, where Henry Silva is like out of focus right in front of the camera and calls towards Marco and Shaw to sort of come and join him. And when Marco and Shaw do join him, they are in focus and Silva is out of focus. And this happens a handful of other times in the movie. And I thought, most prominently, the last time it happens is when the camera is just in front of what's his name? Is it like Iceland?
It is.
Yeah, okay. Such a bizarre name.
Yes.
But the way that Iceland sort of takes the foreground but is out of focus, and Angela Lansbury's character, I don't know, we'll just call her Mom, is in focus behind him. And I think that really like drives home the idea that you can be looking at this thing that's directly in front of you, or this person that's directly in front of you, but what you can't quite see what what you're really supposed to be looking at is going on behind, you know. And I thought that was a really interesting visual thing that they do a few times throughout the movie, is that despite the fact that everybody would be looking at Iceland, the focus should be Lansbury, you know, because yeah. she is the one who pulls the strings.
Yeah, I imagine you came across the them talking about kind of the production of the discussion between Ray and Marco there, as he's sort of realizing the nature of his brainwashing, and Sinatra's face being out of focus.
Yeah, it's the stack deck the first stack deck scene with the two of them. Yes, I did. And actually, it's funny, when I was reading about that, or when I was watching the movie, I was like, oh, this is a mistake, and they just like this take. And I actually ended up being right about it. You know, I didn't think because some of the analysis that's been put towards that is that we're meant to be seeing this from Shaw's perspective, and that Shaw isn't seeing things clearly. And also, since it's cut between an angle where Shaw is looking, the shot where we get of Shaw looking at Marco, I believe, is Shaw looking pretty much right at the camera, like the what would eventually become very famous as a Jonathan Demme shot. He's looking right at the camera, but Marco really isn't. But I think just sort of the way that they were cut, people sort of started to see it as a POV shot, which I don't totally see. But since he was blurry, it was like, oh, it's a representation of Shaw's blurred vision of the way that he sees the world right now, which I don't think is like an improper analysis. I think that's a cool idea to have. But I do love that John Frankenheimer was upfront about it being an accident, you know, and just that Sinatra semi-famously was a one take actor. Like his first take was always his best, according to pretty much everybody. He's the Jay-Z of acting, basically.
I don't know if that's him not being interested in doing more takes and therefore not not trying too hard on subsequent takes.
It's probably that.
Yeah, but it seemed, though, I mean, maybe this is everyone playing nice to get along, but everyone says that they were pleasantly surprised by Frank Sinatra's work ethic on this.
Yeah, I mean, cool. I mean, I just don't like Frank Sinatra's such a complicated person to talk about, like, because there's so much known about him at a time when we didn't really know that much about celebrities, and I don't know, but he still maintains an aura of mystery. I would kind of believe what everybody said about working with him, but I'm also certain that there were probably a couple examples of him not being an ideal human being that have just been forgotten because this movie became a classic pretty quickly.
Yeah, and
because I think that's always the way it works.
Yeah, everyone's saying that he worked so hard and that he was so good with everybody, but this is after saying that shooting has to start at like 1 p.m. because he's always up until 5 a.m. Yeah. You know, like we've already rescheduled literally everything about this shooting of this movie for all the scenes with him in it. And now he's easy to get along with. You know, it's kind of taken with a grain of salt.
But yeah, exactly. He's easy to get along with because we've decided to start every one of our days 7 hours later than we would have on any other movie.
As long as we do everything he says, he's really nice.
Exactly. As long as you do everything he says, he won't bring the mob to break your leg.
Yeah, I forget there was some quote about him watching, because he also demanded that he was able to watch all the dailies involving him right away, and even that introduction scene, which, you know, is a tricky one that had to be edited together, and, you know, that's what's so good about it, is that how well it's edited and how well it flows together.
The dream sequence you're talking about, yes?
Yeah, the dream sequence. So they cut that all together for him to watch. And, you know, it's the quick thing to do. That's definitely not something that they would bother with editing the day of, or, you know, even by the time the very last one is shot, that sort of thing can wait. But he said he wanted that. And someone said, you can hear the threat of him breaking your kneecaps in his voice, even when he's asking for something nicely. So, yeah, I'm with you that I think he's good in this movie. I don't think he's amazing. He says it's his best work, and I don't have a ton to compare it to, really.
Yeah. My experience with Frank Sinatra as an actor is that he's pretty middling, you know?
Yeah.
And I had I had a pretty severe Rat Pack phase at one point in my life, so I have more experience with Frank Sinatra the actor than most people.
That's right, you do. So, yeah, I mean, I think he's fine, but I don't think that the movie succeeds because of him.
No, I think if we're talking about performances, I think is his name Lawrence Harvey, who played Shaw?
Yeah.
I think he's fantastic.
Yeah. Yeah, he's really good, and I'm glad they made the joke of it, but when they talk about him being the warmest, kindest person that anybody has met, and, you know, you've seen him for a few minutes of screen time by this point, and you're thinking, okay, that's not right.
Yeah.
But, yeah, no, I think he's He's got a confidence and an aloofness to him that I think is it really pervasive throughout every bit of his dialogue. And to play this kind of Hitchcockian mama's boy, but also to be kind of brooding and dangerous on his own, I think I don't think it's that easy, and I think he does a great job of it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, part of it is that he's just got the perfect look for this type of character. Like, he looks like an American war hero, you know? He's just very...
I don't know. I see, like, Jude Law plus Daniel Craig with something else in there that I couldn't put my finger on. But he's got a very good, like, 60s leading man look to him.
Absolutely. And fantastic hair, which is very important
undeniable.
for all war heroes to have. But, yeah, no, he's just, I don't know, he's very good. And I was kind of surprised by how much I enjoyed it, especially since this is a time period when acting in general was still more theatrical, you know, like people were more performative. So I don't know. I just found him really impressive. And I thought Angela Lansbury, Jessica Fletcher is her Murder, She Wrote character. I thought she was really fantastic. And I think something that, you know, would be lost to... I don't know. I guess it sort of helps that just the way that people our age think of Angela Lansbury is either Murder, She Wrote or Bedknobs and Broomsticks, right? So it's just sort of counter to the type of role we expect Angela Lansbury to play. So it just sort of just from where we're coming from with our history of Angela Lansbury, I just thought that was a cool little reverse timeline counter casting, you know.
Yeah, and we meet her as the Angela Lansbury that we know, but she's just kind of for the cameras, and until she gets called out by her son, she's very sweet and very pleasant, but the facade crumbles rather quickly, and we do get to see her as this pretty awful domineering presence pretty quickly.
Yeah, exactly. And like, if somebody was to tell you you're gonna watch this movie where Angela Lansbury plays a mom, you'd be like, obviously that makes perfect sense. And then if somebody describes the type of mom that she is in this movie, you're like, oh, it doesn't seem totally right. That doesn't seem like Angela Lansbury that I know. But yeah, and it just sort of it works, you know. She's able to do be on both sides of the line. I think she's very successful at it.
Yeah,
and I think she got nominated for an Oscar, right?
Yeah, best supporting.
Yeah. What's with all the Lincoln imagery in this movie? Like, specifically Lincoln? Because I know there are a lot of pictures of historical figures and everything, but I think Lincoln has really got a commanding lead on the scoreboard there.
I think he's fourth on the call sheet.
Yeah, do you have any take on that? Because I don't. I'm curious to know if you have any thoughts.
I do. Actually, I had the same question for you too. So, I think that, you know, on the surface, this is very much a movie about assassination. You know, we don't really see an assassination, despite the fact that this is, well, I mean, I guess we do. We don't see the intended assassination. This is a movie, you know, the whole Manchurian plot is to assassinate a certain person, it seems, and it doesn't come to be, but I guess they're kind of a weapon to kill anybody they want. That's part of the value of them. So assassination, you know, Lincoln famously assassinated. And I think that this is a time post-World War II, and as communism, as I said, is really kind of tearing the country apart in a way, despite there not being a gigantic communist presence. You know, we're not coming up to a civil war by any means, but it's just the fears of the Cold War kind of taking over within the United States, causing these fears about communism. And like we had the Civil War in the, you know, mid to late 19th century in the States, that this is, you know, by no means a civil war, but as we were speaking about earlier, these people mistrusting their neighbors, mistrusting people in the media, and the Civil War is kind of looked at as the ultimate, you know, you might have to shoot your brother kind of war. You know, if he moved a mile over the state lines, all of a sudden you're sworn enemies just because of some of these geographical and political divides. And that's what I see. I just see the idea of this assassination and this notion that people who are formerly very close to each other, this one country, this one family, this one community, kind of looking at each other in a very distrusting and, you know, varying degrees of violence kind of way. And I don't know if there's anything stronger than that. I think it's, as I said, this movie does this crazy job of flipping back and forth between funny and serious. And, you know, we've talked about the way that this movie's two-faced in a lot of different ways. And it works. The mise-en-scène, you know, all the set direction in this movie can be so weird and it doesn't seem out of place. Like, you can have a bunch of Lincolns and you can have a bunch of, like, gigantic bronze eagles just all over your house. Yeah. And that's fine. It's just one of those things that, and same with just some of the odd camera angles, just one more thing that kind of keeps you on your toes and kind of just these unsettling little bits of filmmaking that put you on edge. And yeah, just the very surprising assassination of Abraham Lincoln, I think, is just one more of those things that makes you think in this movie anything can happen, and that you're not really sure about anybody or any events, you know, 2 minutes down the road.
Yeah,
and I like it. I think it's just one odd thing that it pervades, and it's it does tie into the theme. And even if, you know, I think my answer makes sense, but I'm not sure it's the correct answer or that there is a hard, firm answer to it. It's just one more thing that kind of forces you to try to be aware of everything in this movie.
Yeah, yeah, I like your idea for it as well. I don't have any take on it myself, so I don't have a better answer for sure. But yeah, there's so much Lincoln in this movie that there is definitely some idea behind it. Like the filmmakers had some sort of idea behind it.
Yeah, and it's not in the novel.
No, it's not.
No, that was purely, you know, the director and, you know, I guess some people doing set direction and things like that who plugged that idea in on their own. And I think I like it.
Yeah, no, I agree entirely. I have to correct something I said earlier, because when I was talking about the foreground shots, the last one that I was talking about with Lansbury and Iceland, he is the one in focus and she's the one up front out of focus. And it's like he is the one people are looking at without seeing what is actually they should be seeing that's directly in front of them anyway. She is the one running it, even though she's out of focus because we're all looking at him. So that was just a fundamental misunderstanding of the shot that I had previously.
It still works backwards.
It does work backwards, but it works so much better the way it actually is, you know?
Yeah.
So that needed to be pointed out.
Yeah, and I think one of the cool things about her villainy in this movie is that she, you know, we figure out that she is aligned with the people who did the brainwashing. Mm-hmm. And I think that, I don't know, there's something about her stance on all this, her plan on all of this, that she doesn't seem to really have an ideology. You know, she seems to be a communist, but her scheme also involves getting back the people who helped her out with, because what they did to her son and things like that. And it's just, I don't think this movie takes a hard stance on a lot of things. Like, I don't think this vilifies the left more than it vilifies the right or vice versa. I think that the notion of communism isn't really what's being vilified here either. I think that the idea of brainwashing people and forcing them to be unwitting assassins is obviously not shown in a positive light. But I think that it's interesting that it is this political thriller, but I find it extremely apolitical as far as its stance. Did you have an idea of that?
As far as the left-right sort of thing, I mostly agree with you. I think the main thing is just sort of conspiracy theory in general. I find always has some, like, having any sort of strong belief about a conspiracy theory in any way feels very political to me, even though people on either sides of the spectrum can believe in the same conspiracy theory. But so that's how it feels political to me, just the idea that just the blanket statement, the government is a lie,
Yeah.
So that feels political, but you are right that it doesn't feel like any sort of... It
doesn't feel partisan.
No, I would agree. Yes, I agree with that entirely.
Yeah,
calling it apolitical seems a little too far for me. You know?
Yeah, no, okay, that's fine. Yeah, I guess it's just bipartisan, I guess. And I think you're right. I think it's this idea of conspiracy and maybe a distrust of groups or of government or certain people more so than it is that the left is terrible and the right is great or,
yes,
you know, any other way. And and especially, you know, as we talked about the importance of television increasing and you mentioning the JFK Nixon ones, I think it's just keep an eye on these things that are going to shape your political opinions. You know, you can have your ethics and you can have your values and you can try to line that up left or right, but just be aware of the things that are going to falsely shape your opinion. And I think that's something that allows this movie to persist and allows people on both sides of the aisles to look at this and still consider it interesting without just saying, oh, this is just liberal Hollywood doing this, or this is just, this is just the powerful right-wing corporation wanting you to believe this thing. And I think that that's a way that I believe that it succeeded. And this movie kind of famously had a time out of the public eye. And in 1988, New York Film Festival, it started being shown again, and it would sell out, and a lot of people kind of rediscovered it as this American masterpiece. And I think it's, you know, I think it's just a well-crafted film, but I think it's just like this idea that it's not putting anybody on trial, that you can look at this and take any group and say that this movie is arguing against this or this movie is supporting this and still have a way of that to be right. You know, it's about fundamental truths and finding about what people truly want and why they're acting in a certain way rather than it is saying, you know, just indicting certain areas the political spectrum.
Yeah, well, and I mean also when you look at the history of movies about politics in any way, the ones that last typically are the ones that that either don't I guess picking aside as a lot of these movies do pick aside, like All the President's Men is an example that I've got in my mind, but they're the ones that last aren't the ones where the character turns to the camera and gives a long speech about the importance of democracy and not trusting like one side, one political side. And I think that sort of the bipartisanness of this movie, I think has sort of helped it maintain longevity, just like you're describing in the 80s. It's sort of being seen again and people being able to see it just like they had 25 years ago, just because the political, industry is both an improper way to describe it, but the makeup of politics was still sort of the same. And since this movie didn't like point at any one candidate and say this is faulty, you shouldn't do this, or any one side of an argument, I think it's sort of helped it last. You know?
Yeah. And I think that's not it being two-faced, but kind of being zero-faced. You know, it just kind of letting you plug in what you need to. And I think it's funny that there's so many kind of contradictory actions in this movie. You know, we have the communism looking forward to shopping at Macy's and things like that.
Yeah.
I just think that's they do manage to squeak a good few jokes out of it too, but I think it's kind of that same thing of not really pegging anybody down and that being successful.
Yeah. Yep. Absolutely.
Do you want to talk about that conversation that Rosie and Marco have on the train?
I mean, I really love the line. I know this isn't what what is happening, but the line where Rosie says she feels, I don't know, I guess I felt more or less fragile when she tells him her name. I could never figure it, like, and Frank Sinatra or Marco says, I could never figure out what that phrase meant, more or less. I just really enjoy that line, and I think it's really good in a movie that's, I don't know, about so many different things, and there's just this throwaway line that I enjoy questioning a phrase that we all use pretty frequently, which is something that I like in my movies as throwaway lines. Like I saw The Big Sick again a couple days ago, and there's a line in that is kind of like a more or less line, and I just always enjoy that. But as far as their conversation, it's weird. I think it's a theory that Ebert certainly believed, that Rosie is an agent sent to activate Marco. I like that as an idea. I don't think it was intended, but I certainly like any sort of way too deep reading into a film that I like, so I can support that. Do you have any sort of thoughts about it? Them asking each other if they're Arabic or whatever is so bizarre. You know?
Yeah. And her opening was saying that she's, or almost opening was saying that she's one of the Chinese people who built this railway. I know. It's very unusual. The first time through, and again, there's just some good jokes in there. And I will agree with you that line of her saying, I guess I felt more or less fragile at that moment is, you know, in a movie that we do see some relationships, I mean, I will say that the emotional stuff of Ray falling in love with Josie didn't quite click as hard as I think it intended to with me.
Is it because he said lovable 4,000 times?
That might have something to do with
also,
it.
Also, why have we never gotten champagne drunk when we're hanging out? Like, is that a thing people did in the 50s? To just hang out and just get plastered on champagne? Just seems like a nightmare. Is it because we don't
a lot of bourbon and a bit of water?
Yeah, well, that I'm fine with. That I get. Champagne. It just seems like a prolonged drinking session seems like a nightmare.
No, but in a movie where I think it is, it's engaging, but it's not really emotionally engaging. I think it's more intellectually engaging.
Yes.
I think there's politically engaging, I guess. I think there's a lot of things to think about and enjoy, but it's not so much the interpersonal stuff, but I think that is a good little line that's kind of just like a sweet romantic or a sweet kind of just conversational line that I did enjoy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a very odd conversation, and watching it again, kind of thinking about that theory, I think it's very interesting. And there are times, it's just because Marco is just so, he's already so dazed when that conversation begins, and he's sweaty, as he often is in this movie. Mm-hmm. It does kind of lend itself to that, and I think that, you know, like the set design, like the Abraham Lincoln ubiquity, I think that just having a couple things that you never fully figure it out but always keep you engaged and always keep you looking for clues and guessing is funny, and you know, to keep it interesting but to keep it, as I said, kind of light and funny and kind of sweet, but also this might be the beginning of him becoming an assassin and a murderer again. I think that this movie manages to have it all at a lot of moments, and I think that's just one of the best examples of it, that it does so many things so well and keeps you engaged.
Yeah, I agree. And what you were saying with some of those shots that are just very bizarre, like I think the first one in the movie that really jumps out at you is in that cold open, when Shaw walks into that bar, we get a really low angle shot and we see a bunch of the wall behind him, and there's like God Bless America is written on the wall. There's a flag, I think, but it's just this weirdly low angle, maybe even slightly Dutch angle shot, that just felt very out of place with the time. And I think what makes those types of shots work so well, and helps to accentuate the feeling that you're describing of, you know, these unanticipated moments happening, such as an assassination, is that they come very sparingly. Like the vast majority of this movie is shot like most movies around that time, but there are just some spots where Frankenheimer and his DP or whoever is thinking of these shot ideas throw in these, you know, these gorgeous but kind of weird shots, and I think that they're done sparingly. And you know, this entire movie isn't shot like The Third Man or something like that. You know, I think that that adds to the feeling that you're describing, and I think it's really cool.
Yeah, and we get that especially when Raymond goes to kill the Jordans. Well, kill Senator Jordan, and maybe not Josie, but is forced to at that point. Some more of those high shots, and when he shoots him and he kind of appears to be bleeding milk for a little bit. And yeah, it's this really odd thing. And it just takes you a second to figure out what exactly is happening. And why and what it might represent. And then as she comes down the stairs and we get that shot of the senator lying down dead on the in the foreground, and then Ray standing up so tall, and Josie in the distance, and just she gets shot, and it's just very little dialogue, and she doesn't know what's happening. Clearly, her father didn't know what's happening, and Raymond will quickly soon not really know what happened, and eventually figure it out. But it's in a movie where we're dealing with people who are so clueless. It's very good, even for a couple moments in a shot like that, or a Dutch angle, or when you expect this red liquid to flow out to have this white liquid protrude. Mm-hmm. It does just that, even if it's just for a second or two before your brain lags to piece together why that blood is that color. It just kind of has you on the balls of your feet a lot mentally, and I think that thematically that's so perfect.
Yeah, absolutely. And there are a couple, again, talking about things that sort of feel incongruent for the time. There are a couple like really hard cuts on audio. Like when Shaw is going to the water in Central Park, there's music playing, and as soon as he hits the water, it just cuts off, And that's a very not 1962 thing to do. That's something that, again, like 5 years later, I think it happens in The Graduate 14 times, but that was happening in 1962, while we're still in this transition period, I think is really cool. And there's also that example of it happening again in Shaw's flashbacks when he's thinking about his time, his first time with Josie, and then when he's having, they've got this nice montage as he's describing how lovable the whole thing was, and there's music playing, and then he walks into the room where his mom is, where Angela Lansbury is, a room with a painting of Lincoln and also a bust of Lincoln on her desk, no less. But the second he walks into that room and sees his mom, music cuts off. Which is, again, a very not 1962 thing, and also a very, it's a jarring thing now, even when we're kind of used to these things happening. I can't even imagine how jarring it would have felt in 1962. And again, it just sort of continues to add to the feeling of unease and unanticipated moments that sort of run all throughout this movie.
Yeah, no, it's in so many ways, it feels like it should be 1972, just
for sure.
in the type of movies that were coming out then. And I know that it's that no one was assassinated before 1962, but 63 is JFK, 68 is RFK, 65 is Lee Harvey Oswald, 65 is Malcolm X, 68 is MLK. Like, this idea of these very public shootings of these very important historical figures, not completely unforeseeable, but it just makes so much more sense a decade later that this would be on everybody's mind and would be a pervasive fear for the American public. And it's the fact that it's even before JFK, and in a movie about brainwashing and about conspiracy theories and about foreign governments attempting to overthrow American governments, so many of the meta connections of Frank Sinatra being connected with JFK, yeah, and kind of having to back off because of his ties. I couldn't find another source in this, but I've read John Frankenheimer drove Robert Kennedy to the hotel that he was assassinated at that night. Wow. was only not on stage because he didn't, Robert Kennedy wanted him to, but he thought that would make him look too Hollywood, and that was something that he felt that he should kind of distance himself from. Like, just to be a movie about conspiracy theories that kind of has a bunch of conspiracy theories on its own as a mm-hmm. result of it. And as we discussed, kind of, there's a rumor that it was taken out of circulation after JFK's assassination, for that very reason. It's just all these really wild tie-ins. But yeah, it just feels like it should be at least 10 years after this. And the idea that it's not, and that it's still so engaging and effective to this day, really speaks to a movie that is, more than 50 years old now, that still does such a good job.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't know. Do you have anything else you want to add about the movie?
Nothing essential.
you haven't seen the Jonathan Demme version, the 2004 version, right?
No, I have not.
Okay. I feel like I just want to talk about that just for like 1 minute. Sure. Just yeah. because I feel like it has a lesser reputation than it deserves, which I both understand and don't. I think it's a very good movie. I think you have to sort of remove it from the shadow of this one because this one is obviously better. It took a weird sort of critical beating just because I think because of how good the original was. And if anybody who enjoyed The Manchurian Candidate, the original version, and was on the fence about watching the Demi version, I mean, I wouldn't talk you out of it. It's pretty enjoyable. And also I really enjoy, you know, the use of the, I mentioned it very early on in this podcast, the sort of Jonathan Demme shot where the camera's looking yeah. or the character's looking directly at the camera. And the best example of that is right at the end, right before Shaw kills himself, when Marco and Shaw are looking direct, like we're getting cuts back and forth, but they're both looking directly at camera. And I thought that was really interesting. And I'm curious to know if that is the place that Jonathan Demme got it from. And I just think the fact that he ended up directing a remake of this movie where he uses that like even more than in Silence of the Lambs, from what I can recall.
I thought probably means something. Yeah,
yeah, exactly. But anyway, I just wanted to voice my positive opinion for the remake, which I feel like... it could use one or two people doing that, because I also feel like if that movie came out today, just as it was released in 2004, it would probably get nominated for a handful of Oscars, just because it's the type of movie that doesn't exist anymore. But yeah, thank you for listening to the MacGuffin Man.
You're welcome.
Oh, you're so kind. Be sure to watch every version of The Manchurian Candidate that exists, including whatever remake is made in 10 years. All right, thanks for listening.